I'd like to start by welcoming this kind of debate. I think it's very important that artists should get together about these kinds of subjects, and it happens too rarely. The precise relationships between art and politics I find difficult to locate. And what I've tried to do in these brief notes is to indicate some of the areas in which I've worked and in which politics seems to have become inextricably tangled. The idea of political art seems a little artificial in the sense that one can hardly avoid politics if one is involved in art. To set the scene, I'd like to read two pieces which seem to me to indicate the parameters of the problem. The first one is a cutting from the Evening Standard, which I've been trying to think how to use for several years. I think it's about 1974. Anybody who's into a kind of deteriorating paper art could probably date it from the yellowness of the page. But anyhow, it's about an earl and a countess who were kidnapped in Southern Ireland in about 1974, I think. And the earl is Lord Donemore. And it says, the earl, Lord Donemore, John Michael Henry Healy Hutchinson, sat in the Commons as Tory member for Peterborough for 1943 to 1945. He succeeded his father to the Irish earldom in 1948, etc., etc. Educated at Winchester and Magdalen College, commissioned into the RAC. That's the Royal Armoured Corps, not the Royal Automobile Corps. And served in the Petroleum Warfare Department. And then, a little later on, with incredible mental twist, it says, not a man of political views. This is a Tory member for Peterborough. And it says, Lady Sarah Collins, Lord Dunamore's daughter, said at her home near Kilmarnock, "We are at a loss to know why this has happened. We are waiting, hoping for news." Fair enough. "My father is not a politically active man, and although he is very interested in the local community, it is not a political interest. I don't even know what his political views are, even if he has any." So, we know where we stand. I mean, to be a Tory MP is to be non-political. So, the rest of us are out in the cold a little. And the other thing I want to read to you is a poem. Should I tell you the background? No, I'll tell you the background at the end of the poem. It's called Brightening Factory Life. And there's a little subheading which says, "Employers are watching with great interest an experiment in workshop decoration that is reported to have already made a distinct increase in output. They are brightening up the factory. It looks quite fine and gay, with nicely chosen pictures, because they're finding it will pay. All the walls are decorated by artists most discreet. Every picture has its moral to make our work more fleet. First picture of the pilgrim with heaven in the distance, who plods along his weary way with only Christ's assistance. Next, a picture of the angelus with heads bent down in prayer, and the gleaners bending low their backs in harvest fields stripped bare. There's a picture of a Hindu whose working pay is rice, busy using modern implements, thus forcing down our price." I don't like that bit. "There are mottos on efficiency and panels blue and gold. They figured out the moments because it's labor time that's sold. Then painted saints with haloed hair that help us to aspire. We forget our weary labors here and it makes the output higher. Oh, it is a splendid factory. It looks quite fine and gay. But the reason that they do it, they are finding it will pay." And that was written by a woman called Florrie Rain in the spring of 1921 and comes from Gateshead Labour Party and Trades Council monthly circular of that year. So it's not a new kind of problem that we're faced with here, despite what the 60s taught you. One of my earliest recollections of involvement in art of any kind was in my home village in the north of England. And it was a mining village, and its official designation was a distressed area. In the evenings, once a week, neighbors would come into our front room to make hooky mats. I don't know if you know what they are. They're kind of rag mats. And we all sat around a large wooden frame, about 5 foot by 5 foot, over which was stretched a piece of hessian that was usually washed potato sacks, because we were into recycling very early in Cumberland. Everyone brought old clothes and rags, and these were cut into strips and sorted into colours, and they were then pushed through the sacking. And I can remember wanting to do the design for one of these. And I was given the opportunity, and I vaguely remember drawing a kind of large square and little squares and zigzags and things. And round the border there's a dark strip. That's for kind of practical purposes. and that was, I mean, squares were in that year. And I was reminded of this recently when I went to Chopwell to organise an exhibition there. Chopwell's also a mining village, and Chopwell declared itself a Soviet in 1926. And it's a place that has streets still called Lenin Terrace and Marx Avenue and Engels Street and Keohardy Avenue. I met an old lady there who told me that her friend made a special hooky mat for her husband's birthday in the 20s. She made a design of a very large red hammer and sickle on a black background. And on the day of his birthday, she finished it and she put it down in the front kitchen to surprise him when he came in from the pit. But when he saw it, he was delighted with the mat, but he said, it's sacrilege to walk on it. And so he said, we're not walking on that, woman, hang it on the wall. And so it was hung on the wall. And there's a nice kind of parallel there. And I don't want to draw too kind of pretentious a lesson from the anecdote, but the difference between the first activity with the collective kinds of decisions that were being made and with the social and practical significance, and the second, where a symbol of a political ideology changes the use and the nature of the object, making it important in different terms, seems to me to illuminate some of the areas of interest to the current climate of debate. The difference between the two seems to me significant in the light of my subsequent experiences as an artist, i.e. a person who is isolated in order that he become a specialist producer for our society of art, in inverted commas. I think that much of the current debate about art and politics shows confusion and a blurring of the twin and possibly conflicting ideas of the artist as craftsman on the one hand and the artist as intellectual on the other. Or, to condense it even more, think of the artist as specialist. The artist as craftsman has an implication in current society of the unthinking production of luxury goods, subject presumably to the same vagaries of market and economy as any other worker, and who would of necessity need to organise to protect his conditions and to promote his area of skill collectively. The artist as intellectual contains implications relating to vanguardism and suggesting a kind of objective philosophical detachment. But whatever the amalgam of the two is, the artist as specialist probably gets nearer to defining the problem of a political system which fragments its activities and possibly indicates some of the roots of the malaise that I think many of us feel. At this point, I should say that a lot of my activity over the past decade, at least, has been of a practical nature, to the detriment of any real deep theoretical assessment of what I've done. And I think that one of the most pressing needs is a working theory for artists at the present time, which can resolve some of these contradictions. The lack of this is, I think, the cause of the position of the visual arts in our society, and the lack of any sustained critique in the media, either newspapers or TV. And this fact is in itself an indication of a grossly unsatisfactory state of affairs, and I have a horror of a Roger Fry figure appearing in this vacuum, or a Clement Greenberg even, an English Clement Greenberg. I think the nearest we got to a substantial series of critiques was by John Berger, and he got fed up and went to Switzerland. That being said, I think that, I mean, having said that about written theories, I think that critics and writers and art historians and theoreticians have always tended to see visual art as the illustration of some already well mapped out written theory or set of principles, while they tend to see their own written work as a development of previous theory or lessons drawn from previous practice. And I think this prevents them from understanding that the visual structuring and exploration of experience can be of itself a development. And Regis Debray makes this point well in his book Revolution in the Revolution, where he says that an intellectual, especially if he is a bourgeois, should speak of strategy before all else is normal. Unfortunately, however, the right road, the only feasible one, sets out from tactical data, rising gradually towards a definition of strategy. The abuse of strategy and the lack of tactics is a delightful vice, characteristic of the contemplative man, a vice to which we, by writing these lines, must also plead guilty. All the more reason to remain aware of the inversion of which we are victims when we read theoretical works. They present to us in the form of principles and a rigid framework certain so-called strategic concepts, which in reality are the result of a series of experiments of a tactical nature. Thus it is that we take a result for a point of departure. And I find myself much in sympathy with the view expressed in this piece. Some of the questions raised in my mind by the work I've done in the past, questions such as the relationship between public and private art, between craft and art, between collective actions and individual actions, between art as a product and art as an activity, between art for a recognizable geographic community and art for a less tangible but more broad audience, and the artist as the private researcher and then on the other hand as a public figure, all bear directly on these points. My own attitude has inclined more and more towards a clearer separation of public and private art. As a practicing artist, I feel that primarily the artist should deal with issues publicly in the full consciousness of the fact that society will provide the frame for his or her work and with a clear understanding of the political context and audience. And it was this attitude I tried to come to terms with in an exhibition I did called Strike at Brannan's, where a public show of solidarity had, for example, become impossible in the local media. Again, in a show called Work, Wages and Prices, which was at the ICA in about 74, this was directed primarily at an art audience in an attempt to describe on several levels the invisible political lines and structures at work in our system and to try to, in a sense, direct this at the art public. I tried to do this conscious of audience and context in a rhetorical and some would say simplistic fashion. A series of meetings were held in the exhibition as an attempt to develop this dialogue. I tried to do this in a way which tried to refuse to aestheticize the work. And I was criticized. Several people, for example, reproached me for not enlarging the photos. There was a contact strip all around the room of workers. And make a limited selection from these contact strips. And I suppose with, for example, the Ford Motor assembly line, some of the actual photographs showed highly dangerous industrial situations in which Ford was breaking the rules of health and safety. But that would have made it a different kind of exhibition and a whole new one. And so I suppose the discussion on that aspect followed the lines of the discussions held earlier and the whole debate about colour supplement photographs of the Vietnam War and the whole morality of photographing those kinds of situations. But I think some of the most interesting aspects were raised by the invitation by the ICTU, that's the Irish Congress of Trades Unions, to produce an exhibition on aspects of Northern Ireland, where I was given a fairly specific brief in time and space to be filled, but no brief at all about what aspects, media, subject I might use or approach. In Northern Ireland, people live on the streets in the sense that little happens there that's not an indication of public political attitudes. there are in that sense few really private actions, and the visual signs of the conflict and the contradictions within that conflict are clearly written and painted and published on the streets, and they change from day to day. And in a very clear way, the layers of the conflict, Republican, Loyalist and security forces, all depend very much on this visual information. It defines what are called tribal areas of Belfast and of Derry, and its recognition can be a matter of life or death. And in a way, I was reminded of that hooky mat incident that I talked about earlier when I was in Derry. In Derry there's a gable end at the on the edge of the bog side on which is painted the words, "You are now entering free Derry." And these were sprayed on in paint in 1969, in I think it was October about. And this actual activity of spraying this on the wall that evening, the activity and its content and intention crystallized for the crowds of people there a wide range of feelings and instincts which substantially caught the mood of the people at the time and interpreted it and led to the implementation of the content of that idea. And it had a rightness of scale and of place and a content and time which is rare in any work. And subsequently the words of course were painted out and repainted in a more classical lettering, and they're now a kind of tourist attraction and a memory of a historical event. But that precise moment, there are a few artworks that I would have liked to have done better than that, in its a positiveness. So in this kind of situation where images and colours have a very real significance, a painter like myself, trained in the late 50s and early 60s, may well consider that the London art dealer who screamed down the phone urging officials of the Northern Ireland Arts Council to cross Belfast immediately through constant bombing and collect all the paintings he had lent to the public galleries acted, I hope, contrary to the spirit of the works themselves. And that's where the doubt lies, in the I hope bit. Because one could be forgiven for thinking that this activity called painting and designated art, which in the 50s had seemed like a progressive, liberated and liberating force, had become a selfish and reactionary activity, an introverted and cynical collusion with a series of marketing procedures from which it would be impossible to salvage even the shreds of any dignity. This civilizing and intelligent, this liberating and ennobling activity had degenerated into this, a man rescuing his investments. The concern of art with politics is then necessary if art is to be about the relationship of people to society and of society to reality. This necessitates acknowledgement of the public utility of art at all levels, economic, ideological and political. Hence, I think, the need for flexibility of tactics and consideration of context. Perhaps the key to resolving intrinsic as well as extrinsic progressive principles is in indicating attitudes as yet undefined in written language. So the visual structuring of reality becomes a flexible tool and a weapon, and it may well be that this needs to be looked at tactically, and this approach may well be inconsistent with the monolithic development of the potentialities of a single technique or medium, such as painting or photography or video or performance. These tools may be used to describe current social reality and make an analysis or exposure of that reality to lay the foundations or bases of action, for action. And this is approachable by artists in a different way, using different methods than the writer of literary theories. To put together objects, sounds, images can delineate theory in a different way, and just as different modes create different thoughts, different methods find different ways of approaching reality. Our artists have for some time been under the illusion that they produce art. With a little examination, it seems that a more accurate description would be that societies or political systems dictate what kind of patronage is needed for the kinds of art which are most useful and least dangerous to the stability of and the promotion of the aims and aspirations of that system, which is fine if you're in accordance and agreement with the aims and aspirations of that system. In our society, this has put artists into a situation where what the individual isolated artist finds most difficult is the fact that he isn't the hero of the scene. And he finds it difficult in these circumstances to decentralize himself ideologically. He finds himself in a position of isolated individualism, which contradicts his need to communicate and participate. And pop music provides a good analogy of this with the discovery of the youth market in the early 50s, and the whole youth culture thing. The youth culture of rock music in Liverpool, for example, was lifted out of its roots and internationalized and desanitized and virtually emasculated. And the story of the Beatles is a kind of model of the way this can function, where superstars start from a working class grassroots promoting ideals through a medium rooted in reality, ending up trapped by the system. In the words of one song, I always seem to be quoting rock songs when I give these talks, but they're very good. What have they done to my song, Ma? What have they done to my brain? It's the only thing that I ever did right, and it's coming out all wrong, Ma. Well, I know the feeling, you know.
It's good.
The transformation, then, of an initially radical, hard, and relevant cultural tool for coming to some understanding of the intolerable pressures of a system is thus subverted and isolated until it becomes rootless, eccentric, and finally irrelevant, except to a minority of investors. In all societies, if all societies then produce and cultivate the conditions which nurture the kind of art and artists which are needed to support the political ideology of a particular system, then the function of the politics is to render the system of controls invisible. And in this situation, I think the artist has little choice but to attempt to render them visible for analysis. And probably one of the best illustrations of how this can operate has been the example of the women's movement, who have been extremely successful in renewing our vision and our perspective on the kind of society in which we live. And that's where the political problems start, really, because the system can naturally supply no infrastructure for this. The artists have to work in both new media and concepts, as well as creating the infrastructure through which to communicate it. And this has, I think, been a hallmark of the efforts of many artists in the 70s. If art remains unpoliticized by the artist, then it will be politicized by being depoliticized by the system producing and supporting it. This means that work becomes a public statement, whether the artist thinks it is or not. As such, it is subject to the constraints placed on it by the ruling ideology, and the artist needs to be aware of this, even when there's little he can do about it immediately. The Medicis of the present day in the West are the multinational corporations. And the art forms which they use to promote and perpetuate and develop their ideals are naturally mass-oriented. This art is produced by teams of specialists, technicians, writers, designers, filmmakers, and is disseminated through media and billboards, press, varsities, and the message of this art is a public message. And it's a message which requires that you consume. And the individuals in these teams are specialists who are not allowed to question collectively or individually the basic utility of the forms or the basic necessity for the content worker control. So capitalist realism, whose highest art form is a TV ad, portrays in glowing and critical terms a fantasy world to which it is necessary to aspire in order to belong. And the glowing portrayal of such things as the nuclear family, male-female separation of roles, consumption and acquisition as a social duty, specialization and competition as moral imperatives, all of these it promotes. The compartmentalization of activities is shown as desirable. Work, home, leisure, all are separate areas. And human relationships are reduced to performances, and human qualities are measured in terms of economics. The problem for people trying to expose this area is that the idea of art has been turned into an idea of uniqueness, And this idea of uniqueness has been extracted and made into a preciousness. And this preciousness has then been converted into a relationship about objects and about status. And the artist in this process has been transformed into a prime model and exemplar of a peculiar and vicious type of individualism. So from the existential hero of the 50s to the glib pop star of the 60s, leaving the 70s attempting to redefine the obscured structures and realities of the situation. And in this kind of society, the artist is in one of the most equivocal positions. Because on the one hand, he's directed to interpret and picture the ideology of a society of which he is inextricably a part, and he finds he's inevitably drawn into a conflict between what the effect of his work is and the effect he actually intended it to have. The final points I want to make involve politics in a more direct fashion. In the late 60s, despite 68 and Hornsey, which wasn't really angled from the fine art area, if we can call it that. To mention the word art in the same breath as the word politics was virtually unthinkable in England. And the task at the time for many artists seemed merely to make that simple connection, art, politics. At the time there were, as I've said, no infrastructures outside of the commercial gallery system, and no gallery owners who were sympathetic towards any of these aims. And the gallery system massively distorted the use and definition of art for a great many of artists and people. And there was a very limited series of structures and attitudes. I remember being refused a grant for the exhibition strike on the grounds that video wasn't considered an art medium. There were then those two tasks facing artists who wished to try to work in some way in this area. Firstly, the conditions, the infrastructure, and secondly, new facilities for new techniques, such as posters and books and murals and so on, which had to be developed. And the first real sign that I thought that there was a possibility of changing, for me, was the Art Spectrum show at Alexandra Palace in 1971, where out of 100 or more exhibitors, there were 3 or possibly 4 overtly political pieces in the show. I remember doing a piece that was totally incomprehensible, I think, about the Industrial Relations Bill before it became an act. It became an act during the show, and I think I was the only one there who knew that it was happening. But what was more important in my view was the fact that for the first time in many years, a large number of artists were thrown together in a working situation to talk about the problems involved in being an artist. Such large gatherings are not unusual in the continent, but in England most communication happens through art schools and private views, and that's really non-communication, really. The Spectrum show led to a series of meetings between artists and to an increasing kind of concern and dialogue about the nature of art in society and the artist's role, and inevitably the political nature of art. And the following year I put on that exhibition I talked about earlier on about a strike in my village. And some people have written about this in terms of its results, which was the unionization of a factory. The exhibition was criticized a lot at the time from a number of angles, mostly from the right. And I remember one of the criticisms was that it lacked poetry. That's true. It's true that it lacked poetry. And it's been seen as a kind of key work in that sense, in political terms, because it directly resulted in the unionization of a factory. Now, while I accept the idea that individual pieces of work can work politically in some special circumstances and can in a general way put a severe dent or series of dents in the security of the ruling ideology, I think the more significant political step would be for the many disparate groups of artists to organize collectively in order to improve their conditions of work and to explore and extend the opportunities for living artists to work in all areas of the visual arts, and to give artists a collective public voice on public issues. I think that would be a major aspect in the politicization of art. I think that discussion and debate in terms of style, form, content, the aims of art, the purpose of art, the utility of art, will naturally continue as an internal art dialogue. But unless artists organize themselves collectively to defend the visual arts then they will be condemning themselves to an arid and bleak art practice with an increasingly vicious and bitter competitiveness for decreasing opportunities. I think the recent public performances by the Arts Council and various nameless public galleries in their non-defensive artists has clearly shown that artists have no public defenders except themselves. In the recent non-debates on the visual arts in the media, The Sun, The Express, both galleries and arts councils have acted like towers of jellies. I've mentioned the minute and decreasing coverage of the visual arts in the media. Am I running over time? I've mentioned the minute and decreasing coverage of the visual arts in the media, and I suggest that art writers and critics might well consider coming together to organise a similar lobby for their work, as many of them are already, I suspect, being squeezed out for more comfortable and less contentious and familiar areas, such as books, films, TV, and our beloved English drama. Every artist, an organised artist, was the slogan of the American Artists Union. And I remember a passage in William Townsend's journals, which have just been published recently. And in it, he describes how a contingent of about 400 artists marched in an anti-fascist demonstration. The surrealists, the realists, and the abstract painters, all in their groups, dressed according to their painting style. Now, this was
brilliant. Very good.
This was in the 30s, in the 1930s, in England, through the streets out there. And even in the heady days of 1968, in the Vietnam demonstrations, this was unthinkable. Artists would never get together. They wouldn't agree on that kind of an issue. But it shouldn't be unthinkable for artists as a body to make such public statements. Ultimately, though, artists must realise that it's politics which manipulates art, and not art which manipulates politics. And artists, whatever their style, whatever their medium, whether painter, performer, video, sculpture, documentary artist, whatever their subject, whether flowers or social revolution, should be aware of this. Visual art has been placed outside the arena of debate in our system, and it has been well and truly placed outside of the political decision-making processes. This is a calculated political act reinforced by the apathy of artists, and it has to be resisted by artists in the interests of their own work and its use, self-interest even. And the main way in which this can be done is by working together collectively in order to affect the political structures which affect artists and their work.
Well, thank you very much, Conrad.
The Free International University is an international collective for linking up activities of ever more people in many different areas of cultural, economic, and socio-political experience in regions of England, Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and Italy. In the context of Europe, this represents a new kind of interregional solidarity among people in the smaller and economically weaker outlying parts of Europe, where cultural identity is still comparatively strong. Looked at from the centre, these areas and the problems which concern the university are usually called the periphery of Europe, the more so as important decisions increasingly are channeled via the administrative bodies of the EEC and political choices become centralized in the European Parliament. Were we to call ourselves the Free University of the Periphery, the name would in this context have many meanings. The university has rapidly developed out of a common sense of urgency and concern about the increasing abuse of power, legalized violence and the growth and development of inhuman technologies, and techniques for organizing society which deny basic human rights. We challenge the lack of creative thinking in the economic, political, and social spheres which most affect people's lives, the technical divisions of labor and divisions of academic disciplines which force people to delegate responsibility for far-reaching social changes to so-called experts and specialists. We challenge, too, the equation of politics with politicians and the restriction of the idea of creativity to the cultural fields. In our view, such divisions are the cause of social problems which impoverish the lives of many in society. We are concerned with ways to facilitate the involvement for the many, as well as the few, in the cultural fabric of the present. The myth of professional specialists is deeply ingrained in industrial society, in the educational systems, the media, the cultural institutions, and in the factories, in government, and in every shop in the street. Our aim is to re-involve people much more in creative use of their lives by locating their cultural bases. Those who want democratic change must build and refer to alternative models, and models of communal dialogue and social experiment are what we are trying to develop. Among us are artists, writers, poets, actors, economists, politicians, trade unionists, sociologists, social workers, psychiatrists, educationalists, filmmakers, journalists, prisoners, students, some who work in hospitals, mental homes and prisons, and people not associated with any institutionalized activity, pragmatists and visionaries. Ways of working vary from place to place, but our overriding purpose is to establish a permanent conference and inter-regional cooperation, bringing together three levels of activity: research, open education, and creative workshops, which can look at urgent social issues and how to break the mystique, exclusivity, and conspiracies of silence surrounding the decision-making process.